From NPR News, you're listening to the podcast edition of Weekends on All Things Considered, the best selections from our program on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Guy Raz. This episode, revisiting some of the folks who appeared on the program this past year, we'll hear from Republican Congressman Bob Inglis, who lost his seat in 2010, and Norwegian newspaper columnist Anders Giver about how his country is coping 6 months after the deadly massacre.
We heard the shattering of the glass before we heard the explosion. I knew immediately that this was a bomb.
We'll also get an update from tomato farmer Jamie Boatwright, who's struggling to keep his farm running after Alabama's new immigration law.
I'm worried about how I'm going to take care of my family.
Plus, the Jewish New Testament and the enduring appeal of the TV Yule log.
And we probably watched the TV more than we did the real fireplace.
And later, Bill Cosby joins us with a special Christmas story.
Please do not leave any cookies or milk for Santa because his cholesterol.
And the improvisational pianist Harold O'Neill. We asked him to score an imagined silent movie on the fly. You'll be amazed at what he came up with. That's all on this episode of Weekends on All Things Considered. Thanks for joining us this Christmas Eve. Today and tomorrow, instead of our usual cover story, we'll hear updates from some of the folks who appeared on this program this past year. But first, a look back on 2011. And for us here on this program, January 8th was a day we'll never forget. We began hearing reports that a member of Congress was shot early in the afternoon. And by the time we went to air, NPR's Ted Robbins was on the scene in Tucson, where Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords had been shot.
I am a couple of blocks away, actually, from it was a Safeway supermarket, and she was out in front doing what she calls a Congress on your corner. And a man, she was talking with two people, a man apparently came up.
Egyptian protesters filled the streets of Cairo and other cities today, the country's largest demonstrations in years.
Hundreds of people are dead or missing after an enormous tsunami hit Japan earlier today.
The highways are closed, trains are not running, it's difficult to make phone calls, so the country's just come to a screeching halt.
Tonight, I can report to the American people and to the world that the United States has conducted an operation that killed Osama bin Laden.
By agreeing to raise the federal debt ceiling just hours before the deadline, members of Congress prevented an economic crisis.
I stuck my neck out a mile to try to get an agreement with the President of the United States, but a lot of people in this town can never say yes.
Thousands of protesters filled the streets of Manhattan's financial district last night. They came to show support for Occupy Wall Street.
Banks got bailed out.
It boggles the mind to think about all the things that Steve Jobs did, any one of which would have qualified him as one of the great executives in American history.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. Libya's ousted leader Muammar Gaddafi is dead.
Mourning has begun for the North Korean leader Kim Jong-il, who died from an apparent heart attack over the weekend.
And here, these are the last soldiers to exit Iraq. They are stopped at the border. They have closed the gates at the border.
Those are some of the big stories from 2011. All this hour, today and tomorrow, we're going to check in with some of the people we spoke with throughout the year to get an update on what's happening in their lives today. Last year, I spoke with South Carolina Congressman Bob Inglis just as he was packing up his office. Inglis was one of two Republicans who lost his reelection bid. Now, despite his lifetime rating of 93 from the American Conservative Union, the party establishment turned on Inglis, primarily because of his stance on climate change. He believes it's real and it's man-made. Here's what he told me last year.
I mean, if you look at it, I'm chairman of the local losers club, and there are not many of us in the fraternity. It's only two of us in the House that weren't reelected, that wanted to be reelected. So it is a small fraternity, and so it makes you feel a little bit like a moron.
Congressman Bob Inglis joins me once again from Greenville, South Carolina, for an update. It's great to have you back.
Good to be with you, Guy.
So last time we spoke, you weren't sure what you were going to do after you left Congress, after you lost your bid for re-election. Where'd you end up?
Well, I spent a wonderful spring semester at the Institute of Politics at Harvard University, and then started speaking and writing from a conservative perspective on energy and climate. I'm now doing that full-time, getting ready to launch a new effort persuading the country that there's some wonderful conservative solutions to the energy and climate challenge.
So you are actually going around the country talking to conservatives about climate change, trying to persuade them that this is a conservative cause as well?
Right, and really trying to prepare the country for a conservative solution on energy and climate. You know, if we just do two things, attach all costs to all fuels and eliminate all subsidies for all fuels, then free enterprise can solve the energy and climate challenge.
Are you in a way glad to be out of Washington, out of Congress? Is it kind of a relief?
Well, no, not really. I mean, you know, it's a lot of people when they leave Congress say, well, it wasn't that good anyway. I won't say that because it really was wonderful to be there. It's great to represent a wonderful district in South Carolina, and I wish that I could have continued. But I am grateful for the opportunity to be doing what I'm doing now, which means that I'm able to give full time to this effort of trying to make progress on our energy and climate challenge by addressing it through free enterprise.
How are conservatives reacting to your message? Because you're essentially going against the mainstream Republican message.
The current orthodoxy is adverse to what I'm saying, but I think that received wisdom is going to change. We're going to see a renewal of real conservatism, which is, you know, let's be aware of risk, and then let's move to avoid risk. That's what conservatives generally do. I realize that that's not the current flavor, but I believe that it will become the more natural flavor of conservatives over the next couple of cycles.
It's former Congressman Bob Inglis. He joined us from Greenville, South Carolina. Bob Inglis, thanks so much for the update and happy holidays to you.
Thanks, Guy. Great to be with you.
On a Friday night this past July, it was July 22nd to be exact, we began to hear details about a shooting in Norway. Now, at first, it seemed like an isolated incident. But by Saturday morning, the full extent of the attacks started to become clearer. A series of explosions and then the systematic killing of dozens of young people by an extreme right-wing gunman named Anders Behring Breivik. That morning, we called journalist Anders Giver. He is a columnist at one of Norway's largest newspapers, and he was shaken.
We heard the shattering of the glass before we heard the explosion because they all shattered around us. We are in this big steel and glass structure. And then we heard a big explosion and knew immediately that this was a bomb.
It's Anders Giver, just after the attacks that killed 77 people in Norway. And Anders Giver joins me once again from Oslo to catch up on what is going on in the country. Anders, thanks for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure.
It's probably difficult to answer this, but has Norway, in a sense, sort of moved on from what happened in July?
Well, I don't think we've totally moved on. We're still right in the middle of it. It's on the news every day. It's a big conversation piece. But we have buried our dead and we have started the discussion about responsibility. So in a way, we are moving on, but we haven't really moved away from it yet.
What about Anders Behring Breivik? He has been declared insane by some state psychiatrists. What is the status of his trial?
He's probably going to be declared the insanity plea that he didn't really know what he was doing.
So if he does end up in a mental institution, he may just stay there for a few years, right?
Yeah, well, the whole theory about putting people to mental institutions is that they have a disease and through medication and therapy, they are going to get well again. Some people are saying that this will never happen to Anders Behring Breivik, that he is too dangerous to ever be set free again. But there really is no guarantee.
I know that having been in Norway, that Christmas is a particularly important time of year. Does it feel like a normal Christmas or has this summer's attacks cast
This is not a normal Christmas, not by a long shot. I mean, from where I'm standing, I'm watching a Christmas tree right in front of the government building where you still see all the destruction. So it's not a normal Christmas, but we are better off now than we were 3 months ago, and we are getting there.
That's Anders Giver. He's a columnist for the Norwegian newspaper Verdensgang. He spoke to us back in July after those attacks. Anders, thanks so much for the update, and happy holidays to you.
You too.
Earlier this year, Alabama passed a tough immigration law that prompted thousands of migrant workers to flee the state. Shortly after, we spoke with Jamie Boatwright. He's a fourth-generation tomato farmer in Steele, Alabama. Back then, Boatwright told us that about 20 of his farmhands, all of them from Mexico, left after the law was passed, and it devastated his business. And so Jamie Boatwright tried to hire legal workers. Here's what he told us back then.
Since this law has went in effect, I've had a total of 11 people that were Americans to come and ask for work. A total of one of those actually came back the next day. I told him, yeah, be here at 8 o'clock in the morning. That person picked 4 boxes of tomatoes, walked out of the field and said, I'm done.
That was Jamie Boatwright back in October. We spoke with him this past week from his farm on Chandler Mountain in Steele, Alabama, for an update. Jamie, how are things going now?
Well, right now we're out of season. All the crops are finished. So, you know, we're not having any labor issues because we're not doing anything at this time. But we're unable to plant next year's crop.
You cannot plant next year's crop.
Correct. See, a lot of people don't realize. I think, you know, you start in March or April and you start planting. But it really takes the fall before doing all the planting and pre-ordering seeds and supplies. And we haven't done any of those things.
You haven't done those things because you can't get enough workers to work on your farm?
And unless the law changes, we cannot.
So after the law was passed, most of your workers left. They were worried that they would be deported, right?
Correct.
How many people do you need to keep your farm up and running?
A minimum of 60 people.
60 people. How many do you have working for you now?
Right now, none.
None. When do you have to plant the seeds by for the tomatoes?
We have to plant our first seeds by February the 20th.
By February the 20th, so do you suspect that you may not grow any tomatoes at all next season?
Well, I'll probably grow some tomatoes. It may be, instead of growing my normal 100 acres of tomatoes, it may be like 15 or 20 acres.
Will you be able to pay your bills with that few tomatoes?
No.
So what are you going to do?
I don't have a plan right now. I have studied on it, tried to figure on it every way I can, and right now I do not have a plan of action that I am comfortable with.
Have you tried to convince your former workers to come back and hope for the best?
You know, I talk to some of them on a every couple of week basis. They're in Florida working right now, and they've all told me the same thing. When the law's gone, we'll be back. Until then, we're not coming back to Alabama.
Jamie, I know this might be a difficult question for you to answer because of your circumstances, but can some part of you understand why this law was passed? I mean, of course, there's very high unemployment in the United States, and many Americans are frustrated at the idea that, you know, there may be illegal immigrants doing jobs that they could do.
Well, that's a hard question to answer. I do have an answer for it, but most people wouldn't understand it. But the reason the illegals are here working now is because Americans wouldn't do the job to begin with. This is a fourth-generation farm, and we originally, it was all Americans working, and then we could not get enough help, and the Mexicans slowly worked in because they would show up for work, they would be here on time, and they showed up every morning and was ready to go to work.
So essentially, you cannot continue to do what you do without help from migrant workers.
There's no way.
Are you worried about this next year and about your livelihood?
Yeah, I'm real worried about how, you know, we're going to stay in business, but worse, I'm worried about how I'm going to take care of my family.
That's Jamie Boatwright. He's a tomato farmer in Steele, Alabama. We originally checked in with him in October. Jamie, thank you so much for updating us, and of course, we wish you the best.
Thank you.
The New Testament is constantly reinterpreted from a variety of perspectives. Feminists, socialists, traditionalists, there's even a version as seen through the prism of Star Wars. Well, add to the collection the Jewish Annotated New Testament. Amy Gilavine is a professor of New Testament and Jewish Studies at Vanderbilt University, and along with her colleague Mark Zvi Brettler, she gathered a group of Jewish scholars to put together the first ever annotated version of the New Testament from an entirely Jewish perspective. Levine grew up in a small town in Massachusetts in a predominantly Portuguese Roman Catholic neighborhood, and that's where she first became fascinated with Christianity.
I used to go to Mass with my friends on Saturday afternoon after a day of roller skating, and Mass reminded me of going to my own synagogue. It was men in robes speaking in a language I didn't understand, but somehow it was inspirational and meaningful.
I read that your favorite movie was The Miracle of Our Lady of Fatima. How did your Jewish parents take that?
My parents had explained to me that Christianity was very, very much like Judaism, that we worshiped the same God, the God of creation. We prayed the Psalms together. We thought at least the Ten Commandments were important. So they raised me to think of Christianity as like one of the other synagogues to which we did not attend. And they were happy when I raised questions about what my neighbors were doing, because they thought that was part of how one lived in America.
So I was really surprised to learn that the Jewish Annotated New Testament that you've co-edited, that this is the first time that Jewish scholars have ever been involved in editing the New Testament. But explain to me how this works, because obviously the Jewish faith does not accept Christ as the Messiah. Yet of course, the New Testament is rooted in the resurrection and the works of Jesus after the crucifixion. How does it work when there is so much in the New Testament that Jews would not subscribe to?
Although Jews would not generally say, yes, I believe in Jesus as Lord and Savior or the second person of the Trinity, there's much in the New Testament which comports perfectly with early Jewish history, because much of the ethical material in the New Testament is Jewish, and much of the history presented in the New Testament is Jewish.
One interesting part is Matthew 2, when the wise men or the Magi herald Jesus' birth. Can you explain how you have dealt with that part of the Bible?
Today we tend to look at the Magi as the wise men, and one can find bumper stickers that say the wise men still seek him. But for first century Jews, Magi weren't necessarily wise. They were court astrologers, and sometimes they're seen as figures of humor. One ancient Jewish source, Philo of Alexandria, describes a fellow from the shared scriptures, the Tanakh in Judaism, the Old Testament for the church. His name is Balaam. He's got a donkey who's more clued in than he is. So we can look at the Magi as, in a sense, figures of fun who relate to high humor. To come into Jerusalem and say, where is the one born king of the Jews, while King Herod the Great, identified as king of the Jews, and basically a paranoid megalomaniac, is on the throne, that's not the most astute question. So if we read the Christmas story the way first century readers would have seen, we will find not only profundity, we will find humor, entertainment, history, and politics.
Let me ask you about one of the potentially more controversial parts of the New Testament. This is Matthew 27:25, which refers to the death of Christ, and it says, "His blood be on us and on our children," the Jews. How do you deal with that passage?
Matthew assigns that verse, as the Greek reads, "all the people say this." So for centuries, folks had read this text to say, Jews at all times and all places throughout all generations are responsible for the death of Jesus. And that's how we wind up with Jews being accused of being Christ killers. But for Matthew in his own context, Matthew is thinking about Jesus dying sometime in the early 30s. The children of that crowd for Matthew would be the population of Jerusalem in the year 70, when the city is destroyed and the temple is burned down. Matthew wasn't thinking about generation after generation after generation.
Amy Jalevine, you attend a synagogue in Nashville. You are Jewish. What's been the reaction to your New Testament from the Jewish community, people that you interact with?
Not only in my home congregation, but in synagogues across the country, as well as in Canada and in Australia and in Great Britain, I am being welcomed in to provide some education about early Christianity. I think firmly that if we Jews want Christians to respect us, our practices, our beliefs, our traditions, and our texts, that we need to show the broader world, in particular the Christian world, that same grace and that same courtesy. The blessed thing now is that Jews and Christians today can have this conversation. And by talking with each other, we learn more about each other, and ideally we learn more about ourselves.
That's Amy Jill Levine. She's a professor of New Testament and Jewish Studies at Vanderbilt University. The book she co-edited, The Jewish Annotated New Testament, is out now. Professor Levine, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Now, if history repeats itself, one of the most popular things on TV tomorrow will be a looped 7-minute piece of film that's over 40 years old. It's consistently in the top 3 programs on Christmas morning in some cities, and yet it has no plot, no actors, and it's played for hours at a time. It's the WPIX Yule Log. It's a New York City tradition that now airs across the country. And although it's kitschy to some, it holds a special place in the hearts of many. And as NPR's Siri Grassley reports, the original log has helped spawn a quirky genre of film that's finding new popularity on high-definition televisions.
It's Christmas Eve, a wonderful time for family and friends.
The original televised Yule Log made its debut 45 years ago this Christmas.
The WPIX Yule Log, 2 commercial-free hours.
The program was an immediate hit with New Yorkers, many of whom didn't have a fireplace. Lawrence R. Currie vividly remembers the first time he saw the Yule Log. It was 1972, and his family had just moved to New Jersey.
So we have the fireplace on one side of the family room blazing away in full color and vigor. And then on the other side of the family room, the TV would be blazing away with the Yule Log. And we probably watched the TV more than we did the real fireplace.
R. Currie was enchanted. Since then, he's become one of the Yule Log's biggest supporters. He started a fan website for it and even helped create a new hour of the program in 2006. R. Currie says the Yule Log has always signaled a moment of peaceful reflection for him.
Everything stopped. You knew that when the Yule Log was on, it was time to relax, you know, put the gifts down, stop wrapping, stop the baking, stop whatever you were into, and just enjoy the solemnity of the moment.
The WPIX Yule Log has become a cult hit, but it's never been released on DVD. And R. Currie says it probably won't because of the cost of licensing the iconic Christmas music used in its soundtrack. But even though the genuine Yule Log isn't on DVD, today there are dozens of generic fireplace movies on the market. And as it turns out, filming a fireplace well can be harder than it sounds.
I thought, you know, I would just put a fire together like I did in Boy Scouts and create this ultimate fire.
That's George Ford, the owner of Fireplace for Your Home, a production company in Longview, Washington.
Well, when I set up the camera equipment and the lighting, the first fire just didn't kind of burn right.
He spent over a year trying to perfect it and made more than 30 fires. Each time, he changed an element, like the lighting, log setup, and, yes, the type of wood.
In fact, some of that would be our trade secret. Not too much sap, just enough sap, a little bit of bark, not too much bark. The bark tends to smoke a little bit. The sap tends to snap and crack.
Ford filmed his movie with high-definition televisions in mind, and he's released Blu-ray and 3D versions. He says the end result is so realistic, some customers swear they can feel heat radiating from the TV. And he says sales have been overwhelming. It's all part of the growing popularity of a film genre known as ambient video.
Sometimes I bill myself as the leading academic expert on ambient video.
Jim Bezoki is a professor in the School of Interactive Arts and Technology at Simon Fraser University in Vancouver.
The reason I can do that is I suspect I'm the only one.
Bezoki first started thinking about ambient video over 10 years ago when flat-screen TVs were entering the market.
There's a well-understood phenomenon that a lot of people have consistently left their televisions on. And I thought, well, I suspect artists are going to start making video material, much like living photographs, that people can hang on these flat-panel displays and look at when they're not watching television and they're not watching home theater.
Bezoki says he realized the fireplace version of ambient video was becoming more popular last year when he checked in on cable listings for Yule Logs. On Christmas Eve, there were 20 different options. Just 4 years ago, there were only 4. But if you're cynical about people replacing the real thing with a televised version, Bezoki has a message for you.
Bah humbug. The logic of ambient video is this. I go about my life, and if there's a lull, if for a few minutes I don't know what it is I want to do, I look at something beautiful, and then, you know, then I go back to my life.
It's actually one of Bezoki's favorite party tricks. He's used his own fireplace to make his own video, and on Christmas he plans to play it on a TV, hidden in the hearth. For NPR News, I'm Siri Grassley.
Well, it's probably fair to say that Bill Cosby does not go out of his way to hang elaborate Christmas decorations from his house in western Massachusetts. But every Christmas, his three young grandchildren come for a visit. And last year, Cosby used his connections to get a personal phone call from some of Santa's helpers. He writes about what happened in his new book. It's called I Didn't Ask to Be Born, But I'm Glad I Was. And when I spoke with Cosby this past week, I asked him to describe what his grandkids are like.
They're annoying. I am not the kind of grandfather who really believes that they came from heaven above. I mean, these people make a lot of noise. They blame each other for things. They take turns. It's almost like, okay, 1, 2, 3, and you go in that order, screaming and yelling.
One is age 7.
Seven, and then 2 were 8.
8, okay. So this is a cold Christmas Eve. The kids are not behaving. So you come up with this ingenious plan to get them to cooperate and behave, and the phone rings. And who's on the phone?
It was an assistant to Mr. and Mrs. Claus. And the assistant found that the three grandchildren were not where they're supposed to be. And she had these letters with the requests for presents and the names, and she was checking to see if these were the presents for these children, if these were the children. She called in on my phone, and at first I thought it was Rita Moreno, but it wasn't. It was the assistant.
To Santa Claus.
Yeah, and said, are they there? So I said, yes, just a minute. So I walked into the den of iniquity and yelling. And I said to them, there's an assistant of Santa Claus's on the phone who wants to talk to you guys. And automatically, man,
that's it.
They turned around and looked at me. And I said, come on. And they walked. They looked, reminded me of the Ritz brothers. It was three brothers, a comedy team, and they were stuck together. And they were walking, and came, and I put the assistant on the speakerphone, and the assistant went up and down the list.
The children, of course, I'm assuming, were declaring how good they'd been throughout the year.
Like pro quarterbacks who are taught, you know, forget that last interception.
Now, Mrs. Jones, who was Santa's assistant, she actually, at a certain point, she tells the kids that she's getting another call and that there's somebody else in the line.
Is Skylar.
And Skylar is?
Santa doesn't know where he's going. You know, in the day of computers and things like that, the kids are not where they're supposed to be. Skylar's job is to make the corrections.
Skylar is basically Santa's navigator.
Exactly. And Skylar asked where they were. So we're at Grandpappy and Grandmommy's house. Well, where are they? They really couldn't say because they're always brought to the house.
They didn't know where they were. I mean, they knew they were in Massachusetts.
Yeah, but they couldn't tell anybody how to get there. One description was, well, you get off the plane, then you get in the car, and then when you wake up, you'll be in Greenfield. And he told them he could see them if they went outside and pointed to a certain star.
So you send all three grandchildren outside?
No, I did not.
You didn't? I see. Okay.
No, please. We're on the radio. I don't want people to think Bill Cosby sent his grandchildren
I see.
Out.
Forgive me. Santa's navigator.
It was about 30 degrees below zero. So, but see, these greedy children, that's who we can blame it on. The greed of little children said, okay, go outside. And they were pointing, and all three of them pointed in different directions. And then all I heard Skylar was saying on the phone, which was a speaker, okay, I have it. I know where they are now. So they were called back in.
They came back in, and there was one more phone call. Phone rings again. This is an important call.
This is from an assistant who is, and I didn't know anything about, this was Santa's dietitian. So I said, just a minute, and I put it to the speaker, And I went back to the den of iniquity and yelling and screaming, which they were doing again. And I said, there's another assistant. So here they come. And he, in fact, said to them, please do not leave any cookies or milk.
Wow.
For Santa, because his cholesterol and the triglycerides way up there, which one can see and on pictures of him.
He cannot actually eat the cookies and drink the milk.
No. You could leave out maybe some soy milk.
Oh.
But not 2% plain. No silk.
No silk.
No silk. No chocolate flavored. You know, none of that stuff. Just water.
Or plain soy milk.
Please.
Are the grandkids coming for Christmas this year? Are they with you this year?
They will be here.
So are you planning to arrange for some phone calls for them this year?
I don't think they're going to go for it this time.
That's Bill Cosby. His new book is called I Didn't Ask to Be Born, But I'm Glad I Was. Bill Cosby, thank you so much, and Merry Christmas to you.
And to all grandparents who smile because they see a grandchild.
It's Weekends and All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz, and what you're listening to right now is pianist Harold O'Neill at NPR's Grand Piano. He's released a new album of original solo piano pieces. It's an homage to music from silent films. It's called Marvelous Fantasy. The record is largely improvised, and that's precisely what he's doing right now. Let me get out of the way so we can hear some more. That is Harold O'Neill. His new album is called Marvelous Fantasy. He's here in NPR's Performance Studio 4A with me. Harold, welcome to the program. That was just an absolutely beautiful piece. I didn't recognize it from the new album, though. What is it?
Oh, that's actually a piece that's not on the album. It's a new composition, Dance of the Dream.
And what's it about?
That piece, well, it's inspired by a couple of Ravel pieces. He's one of my favorite classical pianists. Mm-hmm. And this piece, harmonically, is a lot of minor chords moving in all kinds of different intervals. And there's this common rhythmic pulse. So there's something about those sad type of chords moving in a happy way.
Hmm.
So that's kind of the deal with that one.
Interesting you mentioned Ravel. Mm-hmm. I was reading a New York Times review of your record, and it said it's somewhere between Ravel and Duke Ellington, which is pretty high praise. And in listening to it, it actually makes almost perfect sense. It kind of straddles this line between jazz and classical.
Mm.
It's almost hard to define. How would you describe this music?
Well, to tell you that, I'll go back to the inspiration. You know, when I was a kid and first started playing, I didn't know nothing about different styles of music, like most kids. But I did notice that there were these sounds I was hearing with these images I was seeing, and they seemed like the perfect sounds.
You're talking about cartoons.
Yeah, cartoons.
Right.
Yeah, so I wanted to, with this album, I wanted to make a record that someone did not have to be a jazz aficionado, did not have to be a classical enthusiast to be able to appreciate and connect with this music.
Well, we are here in NPR's Performance Studio 4A in front of NPR's Grand Piano with Harold O'Neill, and it would be great to hear something from this record. But before you do that, can you tell me what you're going to play and something about it?
Sure. This piece is entitled Marvelous Fantasy, and it's kind of like the climax of the album. Even though all the pieces are separate, this one's a climax, and this one had the most time put into it as far as work. So this is Marvelous Fantasy.
All right.
Thank you.
That's pianist Harold O'Neill here in NPR's Performance Studio 4A with a piece that appears on his new record. It's called Marvelous Fantasy, and that track is also called Marvelous Fantasy. What a beautiful piece, Harold.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate the opportunity to share that with you guys.
Your background is so interesting and unusual. Your family is American, goes back a few generations, but you were born in Tanzania. How did that happen?
Well, my father was born and raised in Kansas City, Missouri, and my mother's from Tanzania in a village in Arusha. And my father was in the Black Panther Party and moved to Africa in the 70s to change his life, change the pace, get away from that scene and be with his older brother, who's still in exile now over there. He was the leader of the Kansas City chapter of the Panther Party. And my dad went over there and met my mom, changed his life, and decided to raise the rest of the family here in America. So we came back.
I was looking through your Wikipedia entry, and it seems, Harold, that hackers may have broken into it because it has some of the most bizarre stuff anybody could come up with. Here's what it says. On top of being a jazz pianist, you're a b-boy hip-hop dancer. You've been a competitive kickboxer. You're a karate teacher, a shiatsu practitioner, a magician, and you can solve a Rubik's Cube in 30 seconds. Is that all accurate?
Yeah, I guess so. I've got a couple of new things.
I see. That you would add to the page.
Yeah.
So this was not hacked into. This is real.
I would hope so.
Let me ask you about some of these individually. The martial arts, karate.
Yes.
How did you become involved in karate?
I did karate when I was a kid and stuff, but it wasn't really serious. Just a few lessons here and there. But when I was in high school, I had a friend who was a couple of years younger than me, and we would try to pick on him, and he just tossed us around like a sack of potatoes getting thrown out, you know. And I said, "What is going on here?" And he said, "My dad's a karate teacher." And to tell the truth, I was probably like the only one out of that whole group that decided to connect with him and start studying with his dad. And that was years ago. But that's how I got into that.
You are a professional kickboxer, and you go by the name Harold Make Me Kneel O'Neill. Is that right?
Make 'em Kneel O'Neill.
Make 'em Kneel. Sorry, not Make Me Kneel. Yeah, you would want to make them kneel, of course. you're a B-boy.
Yes.
Which is a hip-hop dancer, of course. And you actually appear in a Jay-Z video, Young Forever, which is a great video. Have you tried your hand at hip-hop yourself?
You know, me and my brothers used to do that a lot growing up, but it's way out of practice. But I see the phrasing in jazz, improvisation, and hip-hop is very similar. Because they'll say, and that's... It's the same kind of phrasing. Yeah.
I noticed that the last line of your Wikipedia page entry says that you can solve a Rubik's Cube. What is your record?
You know what? Most of the time I don't keep track, just because I just love doing it.
Right.
But the last time I did it, and it was the fastest time, it was 25 seconds.
Wow.
26-ish.
Harold, I have to test you on your Rubik's Cube skills.
Oh.
And I actually have one.
Whoa!
I actually have a Rubik's Cube right here.
Oh, my God.
And
uh-oh.
I am going, it's all jumbled up.
You don't call me on that number,
I'm going to call you on it.
And I'm going to tell you right now, man, like, all kinds of different numbers come in all the time, and it really just
all
depends
right.
how it's mixed
we are gonna
up.
Time
so
you.
It
I'm
sounds
gonna,
like
gonna,
an excuse, right?
We're going to put you the clock. So I'm going to walk over, hand you this Rubik's Cube, and I'll tell you when to go.
Okay.
All right. Do we have the clock ready? Clock is ready.
This is about to be like 5 minutes, folks.
All right.
Gonna have to cut to commercial.
All right.
Okay.
Go for it. That's an old Rubik's Cube that he's working with, I should say, but he's moving fast. His fingers are moving fast on that Rubik's Cube.
I should have told you, hey, just because it's the fastest time doesn't mean it's the average time.
It's a sticky Rubik's Cube.
Yeah,
this is an original one from the 80s. But we're making progress.
I'm almost done.
We're making progress. Just see his fingers moving fast, like on those piano keys. There it comes. Getting close. Getting close.
Good thing I took down that post that said I could eat like 1,000 firecrackers.
Yeah. Yeah. Good thing you did take that down because, of course, we have a bag.
Okay, I'm done now.
Wow.
Sorry about that.
That's pretty good. That's a minute 18.
That's
pretty impressive.
Yeah, but.
Pretty impressive.
Oh, thank you.
My guest is Harold O'Neill. He's a kickboxer, a Rubik's Cube champion, a b-boy dancer. Most importantly, he is a jazz pianist. And his new album is a collection of pieces for solo piano. It's called Marvelous Fantasy. I know that your great-grandfather was mm-hmm. also a pianist, mm-hmm. but he had a very specific specialty. Can you tell me about him?
Well, actually, I'm named after him and his son, and his name was Harold Pennington.
Hmm.
I found out after a while, after years of playing the piano and doing this, that my great-grandfather played for silent films in Kansas City. And my grandmother told me that she remembers when she was about 5 years old that he had a jazz trio and they would rehearse. And she remembers sitting in the theater.
In Kansas
with him,
City?
In Kansas City, sitting in the theater. Because around that time period, Kansas City was... you know, a certain way with the scene.
Presumably segregated movie theaters.
Right. So she said she remembers being in the theater and sitting behind the piano on the floor next to his feet as he's playing for these films. So,
wow.
That was him.
So he would probably play improvisational piano depending on what was on the screen, right?
That's right. Yeah.
If you don't mind, I thought we would put you through a little exercise inspired by your great-grandfather, Harold.
Oh, wow.
And I'm going to call out some scenes from a silent film. We'll just make it up as we go along, let's say. So,
okay.
And I'd like you to play along. All right, so let's start off with the exposition. Here's a man walking down a city street. Okay, all of a sudden, another man is on that street. He pulls out a gun and he starts chasing this man down the street, Harold. All right, he gets away, right? And as he's running away, he sees his girlfriend, his beautiful girlfriend, and they run toward each other in slow motion. It's a beautiful moment, Harold, but she has a secret that she is keeping from him, and it's a horrible secret. Turns out she's a spy, and she's on a secret mission. Now, just in time, Harold, our hero, our protagonist, finds out, and he saves the day. He manages to find out, and he saves the day. Finale as the credits roll. Thank you. Well, I'd watch that movie for sure. That was incredible. I can't believe you pulled that off. Harold O'Neill, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on the program. Thank you so much, and Merry Christmas to you.
Thank you so much. Happy holidays to you and everyone out there, and thanks for listening and having me here. I really appreciate it.
Before you go, Harold, can I ask you to leave us with one more piece from the new record?
Yes.
And let me know what you're going to play for us.
This piece is entitled The Lovers.
Weekend ending December 25th, 2011, you've been listening to the podcast of Weekends and All Things Considered. The program is directed by Petra Mayer and edited by Kenya Young and Barry Hardiman. This week it was produced by Phil Harrell, Brent Bachman, Lauren Silverman, Lily Percy, Tasneem Shama, Megan Kane, and Jacob Margolis. Steve Lichtai is our senior producer. I'm Guy Raz. We're back next week with more of the best stories and features from All Things Considered on the weekend. And remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. It's on in most places between 5 and 6 p.m. on Saturdays and Sundays. Thanks for listening.